The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running on yet another week of broadcasting here at KPCG, the local station in North Edmond, Oklahoma, the over-the-air station. But, of course, we also stream this live broadcast on kpcg.fm and at the trumpet.com website. One email I'll just read here at the outset, just as a reminder again, that we have all of these programs up on the website as podcasts following the live broadcast. This one here, in response to Friday's show, said, I heard the program and was deeply moved by it. Thank you, and most of all, thank God for this eye-opening and inspiring Bible study on praise and gratitude. I must admit I'm guilty of this sin of ingratitude, but this study has moved me to see how truly blessed we all are. So thank you for this wonderful study. God is making me to see that none of us has anything to really gripe and complain about. It says here, finally, we should be thanking him for everything, no matter what our situation may be. Wow, I'm just in awe over this. So thank you for a truly inspiring study. That, again, is the latest Trumpet Daily Radio Show posted at thetrumpet.com. There's a box for the broadcasts. If you scroll down a little bit, you can get to it from the tabs up top as well. This program and, of course, several others like Trumpet Hour. I'll refer to that one here, the Friday broadcast of Trumpet Hour, in just a second. Well, we had our neighborhood barbecue last night, and I was reminded by one of the attendees that the last time we did that, it was out on the porch and out in the open in the sun, and yet whenever that was, I believe it was in June a couple of years ago, and the weather was pretty chilly that evening, particularly as the sun was going down. Yesterday, we're in the midst of a heat wave, at least by British standards, mid-80s. That's an impressive heat wave over here, and you can see it outside. It's been very dry in recent weeks, and I've never seen the grass here in the Midlands quite so brown. So we're definitely praying for some rain to come down upon us before our youth camp. Our Philadelphia youth camp begins in just a couple of weeks, and if I'm not mistaken, I think the U.S. camp begins today or tomorrow. So lots of youthful activities going on both campuses over the next several weeks, and I'm sure you'll hear some about that even in some of these broadcasts. In any event, it was great to catch up with some of the neighbors and to meet a few of the new ones in this really nice and friendly neighborhood that we're blessed to go back to that email feedback. We really are blessed to be in this location, as one of our neighbors even put it last night. It's amazing that you can live here and feel like you're just right out in the middle of this beautiful area or away from all city life for the most part. That's the way that it feels. And yet you can drive down the half-mile driveway and get onto the A3400 and then get to Stratford-upon-Avon or Henley and Arden in just a few minutes. So you do have easy access to some of the bigger communities. But when you're out here around Edstone, it really is such a peaceful and uplifting and inspiring environment to dwell in. And our neighbors are certainly very grateful for that as well. So as I say, it was nice to catch up with them and to hear about what's getting them excited these days. The English soccer team, for one. Quite a few stories over the weekend about the jubilant fans in England now that they've made it to the semifinal. And also a few headlines about the fans going a little overboard, as is sometimes the case with soccer fans, not just in England, but around the world. But England certainly has had its issues in the past with respect to going overboard with it. The other big news over the weekend is the resignation in Prime Minister May's government. The Brexit Secretary, David Davis, he quit his position last night, and the Spectator calls this the biggest political crisis that Theresa May has faced since she lost the majority in the general election. And Davis evidently just couldn't stomach the ongoing negotiations between the UK and the EU, as Britain is in the course of exiting the Union. And Davis was hoping for something more. This is all explained in The Spectator. He was hoping for something more like the deal Britain has with Canada, the free trade deal. But this deal that's basically been forced along by Ms. May's government, it certainly keeps the EU, or rather keeps Britain, within the EU's regulatory orbit, as The Spectator puts it. And so as of last night, Mr. Davis had enough. And then I think we heard earlier this morning, too, that one of his junior ministers, Steve Baker, he too resigned. So there's quite a division, a sharp division, within the Conservative Party here in the UK over the contentious negotiations regarding Brexit. Melanie Phillips had this to say just this morning. She says, "We don't yet know whether Brexiteers in the Conservative Party will seek to bring down the Prime Minister Theresa May over the UK negotiating position that she forced through Cabinet on Friday. We don't know whether the EU will accept her compromise," she has in quotes, "her compromise package, or will reject it with the contempt they have shown until now at any suggestion of a pick-and-mix approach to the EU's customs union and rules. But what we can say," Melanie Phillips writes, "with near certainty, is that what Mrs. May has done is put in serious doubt a Conservative victory in the next general election, and maybe at any further general election for a long time after that." So, as I say, sharp division in the Conservative Party. Melanie says here, "For she and her cowardly and faithless colleagues have betrayed Brexit voters, betrayed democracy, and betrayed the British people. They're not following through on their promise. They're not supporting the majority of those who voted to leave." And we spoke with some of them last night at our barbecue, and they were talking about the division that there is between those here in the Midlands and north of here, and those in and around the London area and south of London, a sharp division over staying in the EU or leaving. And of course, the majority, and that would be in this area for sure. I think I saw a map last year or the year before when it happened, all the counties around here, excepting just the very heart of Birmingham. But this was very much a pro-Brexit region here in the West Midlands. Melanie Phillips, together with her article this morning, she tweeted out that we need to somehow get Nigel Farage in. This was something she related to us when she was down in Jerusalem at the ceremony we had for the new archaeological exhibit. She was there, and I believe it was one of our members who was talking to her, asking if she felt like there was anyone in British politics that could lead in the same spirit of Donald Trump. And she pointed to Nigel Farage, who is a Trump supporter himself. But she, in her tweet, said that Theresa May needs to be sacked and Farage needs to preside over the Brexit negotiations. "Too fanciful," she writes. "Desperate times need desperate measures. Public faith in democratic process now is in danger. These are desperate times." This is a world in turmoil. You see it. You see it all over the world. I mean, instability is the order of the day. Whether it's the governments in Europe or here in the UK, in the United States, you have the division in the United States, as I'll get to here in just a second, between Republicans and Democrats. But then you also have a pretty sharp division between Republicans who support Trump and those who don't. And then you have a sharp division in the Democrat Party as well. The radical communist left and those that are the more traditional Democrats who are losing out, really, to the Bernie Sanders wing. The Washington Free Beacon had an article today or yesterday about who killed the center left. I mean, where is it now? Where is the center left? You know, the more moderate Democrats. You don't see them. It says the only civil war happening at the moment is within the Democratic Party. Well, I'm not so sure about that. In any event, it says the old guard corporatists are under attack from activists with radical goals and immoderate tempers. You can trace a line from Occupy Wall Street in 2011 through Black Lives Matter in 2013 through Bernie Sanders in 2016 through the Women's March a year later. Tom Steyer and Maxine Waters' impeachment campaigns, the growing prominence of Democratic Socialists of America, and the movement to abolish immigration and customs enforcement today. This radical left, they want to get rid of ICE, the border security. And there was all the hoopla, of course, recently over that race in New York. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez defeating Joe Crowley, and she proudly proclaims herself to be a Democrat socialist or a Democratic socialist. And this is the topic that was discussed at the top of the show on Friday, the Trumpet Hour, between Joel Hilliker there and Andrew Miller, and also Richard Palmer chimed in a fair bit, just talking about the movement among young people in particular, and the strong support they have for the communist wing, basically, whether it's Jeremy Corbyn here in the UK or Bernie Sanders and the like in the United States. Here comes this 28-year-old Democrat socialist who's campaigning on all of these promises, healthcare for everyone, jobs for everyone. And oh yeah, let's get rid of ICE. We'll just get rid of border security. I mean, this is even Jay Johnson from the Obama administration wrote at the Washington Post to call for ICE to be abolished. That's not a serious political proposal. And yet it's put out there by this new darling, Ocasio-Cortez. She was, who's the head of the DNC? He's saying she's the future. She's the future of the party. Well, we had an article. This is actually some of what Andrew Miller was saying on the Trumpet Hour Friday, but this was posted at the Trumpet.com website. Andrew says here, arguably the most interesting aspect of Cortez's portfolio is her membership in the Democratic Socialists of America. This organization was founded in 1982 when an offshoot of the Socialist Party of America merged with the New American Movement. It opposes the free market and says that the whole economy should be centrally planned. This is a growing movement. I think Andrew said on Friday that it's grown by like 10 times since the election of Donald Trump. I mean, it's part of the resistance. The resistance against Donald Trump. They hate the free market. They hate capitalism. Andrew, in his piece, he quotes from Investor's Business Daily, which says, sadly, a mere 28 years after the collapse of communism, a new generation of youth, not then born or too young to understand it, see that epical event as ancient history, irrelevant to their new understanding of the world. They don't know history. They don't know about the collapse of communism. IBD says they do not understand that the toppling of communism wasn't merely a repudiation of the gerontocratic rulers of communism, but of the very idea of socialism. I mean, everywhere that it's gone, it's failed. Everywhere you started out with the democratic socialist agenda, it turns into this, as Andrew brought out Friday, it turns into this very authoritarian communist movement. And yet our young people, they know very little about this history. And of course, more shameful than that is the fact that they're instructors, they're professors. They're out there glorifying socialism, glorifying communism, and urging young people to stand up and resist. Part of the resistance. Look at the crazy reaction to the Supreme Court nomination, which President Trump says he's going to be making, I guess, this evening. He says it'll be an exceptional person, but that's not the way the other side sees it. It doesn't even matter that they haven't announced it yet. They know. They know that this is going to be a right-wing extremist. I thought it was interesting. Again, on Trumpet Hour, Andrew Miller was talking about going back to when these young people weren't even born. He was talking about President Bill Clinton's campaign, or his campaign for presidency in 1992, and how it was very similar to Donald Trump's 2 years ago. Very similar. I mean, it just shows. It shows how radical the swing has been since 1992. I mean, all through the 90s, you had the Clintons and the Trump family. They were bosom buddies, hugging each other, posing for photos, attending each other's weddings. But now Donald Trump, of all people, he's the right-wing extremist. And whoever he nominates tonight is going to be a right-wing extremist, a conservative. And we cannot have an evil conservative on the Supreme Court. Look how things have changed and how dramatically so. Well, my father talked about the Antiochus administration, the attack on America. And so, as I brought out on a recent program, I mean, you see it. You see it. You see that attack right out in the open. And really, since Herbert Armstrong died back in 1986, listen to what the media are saying now regarding this supposed conservative judge. We don't even know who the president's going to nominate just yet. But this is how the media have been reacting over the past few days since Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement. This is clip one.
What's the court going to look like for the next 30
years? We're looking at a destruction of the Constitution of the United States, as far as I can tell.
This is a line that's been drawn about whether we are going to criminalize women.
This nomination could move the court in a really dangerous direction.
It's a very thin line between putting a woman in prison for a stillbirth or a miscarriage that she's blamed for something she did during her pregnancy, and criminalizing abortion.
What if birth control was illegal? What would you do if birth control was illegal? It used to be illegal in some places.
Justice, that would reverse Roe. What happens? In essence, we go to 50 civil wars in each of the states, plus the District of Columbia.
For instance, federal survivor benefits from Social Security, federal worker pensions could be lost.
They also want to criminalize abortion in this country. They're literally trying to punish women.
You know, if he does pick a woman, she'll be known as the Aunt Lydia of the Supreme Court.
And I think the legacy that this president is creating really is turning back the clock 100 years.
But we are in an unparalleled moment of assault on the rule of law when our fundamental liberties are in danger.
Equal rights, equal freedoms, equal liberty. It's an issue of life and death for a lot of women.
I mean, we might lose some of the most precious ideals of our country.
So basically, if you are not a straight white male in America right now, you are probably freaking out.
If I were involved in a same-sex marriage in one of those states, I'd be panicked.
And say to them, your health care rights, protection against pre-existing condition abuses is at stake. Clean air and water that you use and breathe is at stake. The future of your rights to reproduction decisions is at stake.
Women who are in states that do not have protection, but who need abortions, who literally need abortions, are going to suffer from it. Unions, people who are in unions, are going to suffer. And so
this is not a fire drill.
This may be the pull the fire alarm moment that you have been expecting.
This is definitely the break the glass moment.
The fundamental rule of law that is at stake.
This is an issue of extraordinary human rights on the line for generations to come.
Wow. Well, those are the alarmists in the media. That montage, by the way, was put together by Grabian. But here we're, I mean, clean air is at stake with this nominee. The destruction of the Constitution. I made this point last week. Now, all of a sudden, the radical left is talking about upholding the Constitution of all things. Their version of what the Constitution is or means. Civil wars across all of America. 50 civil wars. Women going to prison, criminalizing abortion. And the name hasn't even been put forward. Listen to this. This is almost laughable. This is a sampling from our college campuses in America. These are people commenting on who Donald Trump nominated when he hasn't even yet made the nomination. This is montage two.
What's your reaction to the justice that he nominated today?
I'm honestly not surprised by his choice, but yeah. That's just worse for us.
I just saw the pick and I was like, it's almost at a point where you kind of expect that it's not going to be what you want.
He's quite, you know, extreme in his views, and I don't know if it would make the Supreme Court very even.
This new, like, nominee is very racist, and I think it's starting a new wave of something very negative, and I'm really scared about what will happen in the future and what choices he'll make.
And so what reaction have you seen on social media today after the news?
Oh, outrage, as it should be.
His entire cabinet and everyone he's chosen has been the white supremacist Legion of Doom, and it's dangerous to everyone who looks like me. They should all wear white hoods and burn crosses at the Capitol.
And the fact that he would put someone up there that is so racist and is not practicing the equality that we need to see, it's, again, it's insulting, and it's, he's not gonna last.
I did speak to my dad a couple days ago, and I know he was not a huge fan of the decision that he made.
If you were picking a Supreme Court justice, what qualities would you want them to have?
Someone who's actually just. I definitely want them to be liberal and look to the views of the minorities. Like, the previous Supreme Court justice was a swing vote. Like, you should have some balance. You shouldn't just be all on one side.
President Obama did pick two liberal justices, though.
But now it's all conservative.
We have to just keep getting our voices out there.
Keep resisting.
Really, yeah, we have to. Because, like, obviously if that's his pick, then, like, there's nothing we can truly, truly, like, do as, like, citizens other than, like, really get our voices out there.
Winston Churchill said the best argument against democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter. I went through that article by Victor Davis Hanson a week or two ago where he talked about the ignorance and the arrogance coming out of the university today. And that's what you heard there. People who don't even know that the nomination hasn't been made yet, and yet arrogantly going along. Yeah, but just saw the pick and don't like it. Don't like it. I did speak to my dad about the nomination. I was talking to my dad about the nomination. I mean, is there not anyone in the group that could say, hey, I didn't hear. Who is it? Who is the one that was nominated? Do we know anything about him? Do we know anything about her? Have we studied some of the opinions that he's written? None of that. I mean, this is serious. God says in Hosea 4 that his people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. I mean, you can't even get to the knowledge of the truth. It's all agenda. It's all bias. It's all just brainwashed. Ignorance and arrogance. Well, I'm going to talk in the second segment about the importance of study and truth, something that, you know, we have discussed before, but still, when you look at this world. It's going dark. You just can't get to the light of the truth unless you are actively seeking it out. Andrew McCarthy, he had a piece at National Review saying that it's a sign of our wayward times that a conservative, quote unquote, a conservative judge is one committed to construing the law as it is written in accordance with what it was commonly understood to mean when adopted. You might think that's simply what a judge is. But that's not what the radical left is looking for. They're not looking for a judge who's committed to construing the law as it's written in accordance with what it was commonly understood to mean when adopted. What they want instead is an activist. An activist who's motivated by their political ideology, first and foremost. It says here, progressives rely on robed legislators to block the elected officials who beat them at the polls and to impose on the nation what they cannot enact democratically. These are known as judges with empathy. This is Andy McCarthy. And see, they've lost the presidency. They don't have a majority in Congress. And so, I mean, this is their last line of defense. They need those left-wing justices on the Supreme Court to block the elected officials, to impose on the nation what they cannot enact democratically. I mean, McCarthy brings out here, you only have all the fuss over Roe v. Wade when there's a Republican nomination in play. Because they know it's not based on constitutional law. And look, if in a democratic society they were really concerned that it might be overturned, well, still, if the majority of the people want it, you pass it as legislation. And then it becomes the law of the land. And not just what five Supreme Court justices say about the Constitution. Well, it's not even Roe v. Wade, as Andy McCarthy brings out. And we talked about the 1992 ruling that Anthony Kennedy, as it happens, he's the one that led the charge there, basically upholding Roe v. Wade. 19 years after Roe v. Wade, the Casey case. Well, it says here, this is bits and pieces of some that we quoted a week or two ago when Kennedy announced his retirement. But this is McCarthy writing about the 1992 ruling, saying that Kennedy and company proclaimed in Casey's opening line that liberty finds no refuge in a jurisprudence of doubt. And who could possibly doubt the justices? Jurisprudence, he says, an account of liberty sprung not from legal precedent, but from a metaphorical heart bursting with the right to define, this is quoting the opinion, the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. That's Anthony Kennedy back in 1992 waxing eloquent about how that, well, we need to be able to sort of do what seems right in our own eyes. And that's the sort of precedent that's held to this day. McCarthy says, we'd been warned that the Constitution is living and organic, but who knew it was hallucinogenic? And that's where we are today. And Roe is not a one-off, as McCarthy concludes. It was a dramatic but foreseeable progression. This is the path that we've been on over the past couple of generations. A progression in the court's oxymoronic substantive due process, jurisprudence, of the mystery of human life, realm of personhood. He says the modern phase started with contraception. It has since moved on to gay rights. And now we are on the LGBTQ rights. Three-partner marriage and, well, why stop there? And who knows what other transgressive erosions of bourgeois culture. Well, it's another good piece by Andy McCarthy. And we'll just see what happens tomorrow after the nomination is made. If Mr. Trump's going to stick with one that is a so-called conservative, or it would be better to term him as a strict constitutionalist. You would think that's what everyone in the United States would want. I mean, these are the founding documents. We spent a lot of time last week about these founding documents. This is what established the nation. But it shows, doesn't it? It just shows. It's the sign of our wayward times, as McCarthy says at the start of his piece. You look at the Democratic Party. You compare the campaigns of Bill Clinton in 1992 with Donald Trump in 2016. And how far the United States has fallen. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about Churchillian leadership and what made him such a fantastic leader during those war years. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Now we had come to the place here where Jesus was sending his 12 disciples. And remember that the word disciple means a student or a learner. And so they were going to school, so to speak, to him. And they traveled around with him for 3.5 years. He taught them. They traveled. And education comes by travel. Education comes by teaching. Or it doesn't make any difference whether you get it verbally or whether you get it from a book, just so you get it. And Jesus gave it to them apparently verbally, but they also had it in writing because they did study the scriptures. And you get education from travel, and you get education from experience. Now, they had traveled with him, and here he's sending them on a trip for travel and also to gain experience. He is sending them out on a sort of practice preaching mission to proclaim his truth.
That's Herbert Armstrong from a program back in the 1960s talking about how we come to the knowledge of God. Disciple means student or learner. They were learning from Jesus Christ. They were being educated. They were getting it verbally, and also they were studying the scriptures. Mr. Armstrong often talked about Jesus Christ, or how the Bible is Jesus Christ in print. So you have the book. You can open the book and peer into God's mind. You can receive the truth of God. In his autobiography, Herbert Armstrong talked about, again, education more generally than that quote I just gave to you. But he said in the autobiography, education comes from study, from books, from lectures, from contacts, from travel, from thinking about what you see and hear and read, and from experience. He says the reason we have to maintain schools and universities is simply that most people are too lazy. Most lack the ambition and persistence, the drive to procure an education outside of schools and colleges. I mean, I played the montage in the first segment. Look at the ignorance. Look at the ignorance. And why is this so common? Why aren't they receiving more at the university level? They're clearly not going at it on their own. And then they get into the university and shame on the instructors who give them nothing. Nothing of value. Ignorance and arrogance. Well, here in the case of Herbert Armstrong, I mean, he didn't even get a formal education, not in the university sense. And yet that man, that young man, was very educated and driven to study. He says in his autobiography elsewhere just how much of an impact biographies had on him, Ben Franklin's in particular, but he said, I also read many, many other books about great men and women, biographies, autobiographies, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Bernard Baruch, Theodore Roosevelt, and many others, he said, and then he talked about it in the terms of the Bible, saying that, look, you can read about the Apostle Paul's life experiences and his letters. And in the book of Acts, you've got the first four books of the New Testament that have to do with the ministry of Jesus Christ. And then all the Old Testament prophets. You have the biographical sketches included in their books on occasion. Of course, the history, as it's recorded in books like Samuel and Kings and Chronicles. I mean, where would we be as far as our spiritual understanding is concerned if we didn't read the Bible, if we didn't study these books, if we didn't open the book and just go through it word by word by word? In The Closing of the American Mind, this book by Professor Bloom, Alan Bloom, the late Professor Bloom, he said, at all events, whatever the cause, our students have lost the practice of and the taste for reading. They don't have any taste for reading anymore. They've not learned how to read, nor do they have the expectation of delight or improvement from reading. I mean, they don't really experience the joy that comes from reading and understanding. It's all just given to them on a platter, and so much of it is just waste. It's just nothing. Professor Bloom's writing this in 1987? 1986? He's talking about the state of the American university, something like 30 years ago. Bloom says, the failure to read good books both enfeebles the vision and strengthens our most fatal tendency, the belief that the here and now is all there is. We lose our vision. What does the Bible say about vision, or lack thereof? It says, if you don't have vision, you perish. You will perish. You will die. You will shrivel up and die. The belief that the here and now is all that there is. You think there's quite a few people in our nations today who believe that all there is just what's right here in front of us? Oh, here comes an interviewer. He says, the nomination's been made. I know it's coming from Donald Trump. It has to be bad, so I know exactly what to say. Here and now. The belief that the here and now is all there is. My father gave a lecture about a year ago. It was last year around this time. 7 keys for building leadership. He gave it as a youth camp lecture or message, and went through the example of Winston Churchill. And then a few months later, it came out as the featured article in our Royal Vision magazine. If you don't subscribe to that, by the way, send in your request. Send in your request for Royal Vision. We send that out to those who are actively engaged in supporting this work. That, in addition to the Trumpet magazine, you need both. But here's this brilliant article from several months ago now. 7 keys for building leadership. And my father in it, he uses the example of Winston Churchill. And in particular, he draws attention to one of his biographers, William Manchester, who wrote The Last Lion. These three works. Well, Manchester died after he completed the second one, and he was in the process of researching for the third and final installment. And then he had to hand over his research to another author who helped him finish the third volume. But writing about those first two volumes in particular, my father says that William Manchester wrote one of the most dramatic biographies of Churchill. He got to the point of what Churchill was all about in a way that many biographers fail to do. And he wrote over 100 pages in the first volume about the ordeal Churchill had to go through with his parents. And this is how my father introduced his camp lecture. All of the disadvantages that Churchill had as a youth. The fact that his father practically hated him, thought he would be a failure. And his mother was running around with all of these men, promiscuous living. And he was failing in school. He wanted attention. He wanted attention from his parents, and he couldn't get any. And then he went to school, and he was just bored to tears. The only thing that he liked, the only thing he really liked at school was history and the English language. And he was into some sports here and there, but even there, I mean, he was picked on. And my father last year talked about his nanny and just how precious she was. And how she devoted her life to him. And how she inspired young Winston. And got him excited about education. And got him excited about learning. And read biblical passages to him. And really had a strong influence on his morality. His ethic. His standard of living. Well, my father mentions volume one, those first 100 pages. I guess if you put all three books together, it would be a daunting task to get through it even in a year. But as much as you can get through, I would highly recommend it. Or if you're having a hard time devouring the entire book, read that first 100 pages or so in volume one and learn about his early youth. I think the first 100 pages in the second volume is really, really inspiring because it has to do with Churchill's daily routine as a man, how he managed his time, how he structured his day, and how incredibly productive it was. And then even into the third volume, which might be the most challenging to get through because it's just got so many tedious details about the war, World War II, and then the years after as well. But if you just took that one and read the first 60 or 70 pages and you get a nice summary of Churchill and the previous two volumes, and again, it talks often about Churchill's character. It just kind of summarizes Churchill in a magnificent kind of way. My father talked about with this, all these other biographers like Martin Gilbert. I think Martin Gilbert had something like 9 volumes, and how that Manchester, because his life was cut short, he only got through the first 2 volumes of his 3-volume set. But as my father said last year, he had such an awesome focus. And all right, he made a few mistakes. Maybe it wasn't the most perfect biography in the world. And those few mistakes he made here and there, it opened himself up to some criticism. But he got the big point. He knew what Churchill was all about and what it meant for the world, his leadership. He saved the Western world. That's how important this man was. That's awesome when you think about it. I mean, what a significant personality insofar as world history is concerned. And yet, how many biographers really grasp the true significance of what that man did? As I said to you last week, I mean, here they are at Oxford Union today still debating whether or not they should be ashamed of Churchill. William Manchester wasn't ashamed of him. I mean, it's three volumes, and you do read there in those volumes about his weaknesses. He had weaknesses. Everyone does. But these colossal strengths. How could you get to the end of your study, supposing you even studied it at all, and conclude, I don't know, I'm ashamed of him? Well, that's just one article here or there that somebody Googled, and they fill their mind with that and that alone, and they come away convinced. Oh, we're ashamed of that history. We sure are ashamed. There's no balanced education in that sort of reasoning. So many biographers, they don't grasp the true significance. Manchester did. He did. He saw how Churchill made the British people believe that they were, look, we're a heroic people. We would rather see our blessed city of London go up in flames than to submit to the rule of a tyrant. We'll fight to the death if we have to. We'll fight for other nations. We'll fight for freedom and democracy. It was Churchill, his voice, his writings that changed the thinking of this nation. Britain, like so many others involved in the Great War, the First World War, they came away from that war weary. They didn't want another war. They were tired of fighting. And Churchill had to arouse that fighting spirit. And that's what Manchester focused on in so many ways. Even one of Churchill's critics, my father brought out in that message from a year ago, one of his fiercest critics acknowledged following World War II that he was in fact a hero. Why? Well, because he saved our lives. That's why. Did you know the British people promptly voted him out of office as soon as the war ended? He saved our lives. You think on that alone, you would think on that alone, they'd keep him in for 2, 3, 4 more terms. But that's not what happened. Just bring him in there when we know what he said for 6 years is absolutely right. Bring him in because we need a fighter. We need a bulldog. But as soon as the war's over, let's return to smooth things. That's what we want. He saved our lives. Manchester just kept hammering away at that angle. He saved the Western world. Churchill was concerned about the salvation of mankind, my father said last summer. So you can see why he gave us such a strong admonition. We, in the church, I mean, to study this man's life, to build these keys for leadership. One of which is a love for history. A leader must learn history. A leader must love history. Brad McDonald had an article back in June of 2006, titled The Death of Churchillian Leadership. It's gone in so many ways. And he brings out a lot of inspiring points in his piece. How that so many great leaders of history are self-educated. Mr. Armstrong was. I mean, he never would have been in the position he ended up in if he wasn't a diligent studier, diligently reading chapter and verse, outside reading biographies, as he said in the autobiography. Churchill was the same way. Brad McDonald says here, prestigious degrees from renowned universities do not make a great leader. Often, if a person relies too heavily on a spoon-fed education without really considering and proving what is being taught, his leadership can be short-sighted. Unless it combines with self-education, modern education can handicap a person's leadership. I mean, it can actually work against you. Churchill spent years educating himself rather than simply accepting as truth the liberal doctrines of universities. He educated himself in Macaulay, in Shakespeare, and the like, Gibbon. It's just like Mr. Armstrong. And, of course, you go back to that history from the 1930s. Brad McDonald there talking about how, in so many ways, what you get at the university level, it works against your leadership ability. Look at who was fighting him most, Churchill. Look at who fought him in the mid to late 30s, 1930s. The scholars. I mean, Baldwin and Chamberlain and Halifax and these guys, they were educated men. They were university men. They were scholars. And the Oxford Union, well, they just laughed at Churchill. He goes to speak at Oxford, and they laugh him to scorn. You're crazy. You're ridiculous. You are ignorant. Mr. McDonald says here, Churchill studied a range of subjects, constantly weighing what he was reading against history and experience. Winston Churchill, his son Randolph later said, became his own university. He was self-taught. Herbert Armstrong was self-taught. Of course, in that case, it's a little different because God was opening Mr. Armstrong's mind to the truth. And all that's recounted in the autobiography. I mean, you talk about a life-changing read. Read Herbert Armstrong's autobiography. And then if you want to venture out beyond that to a leader, a towering figure of history, read Manchester's, Volume 1 or Volume 2. If you have time for only one, maybe Volume 2. If you have time for a little bit from each, maybe the first 75 to 100 pages of each one. Make time for it, though. You'll be glad you did. Churchill made time for reading. Brad McDonald says here, as a young soldier in India, Churchill spent hours every day reading books. And then he quotes from this other book here, the discipline of self-education that Winston so passionately and aggressively practiced during those hot Bangalore afternoons remained with him throughout his life. He was off in this far remote location with quite a few hours in the morning before he would have to carry on with his duties. And he pushed himself to read for 4 and 5 hours a day. He did this as a young man in his 20s. Because he knew how important it was for his future, for his leadership ability, for his education overall. Quoting from this source, it says, he read ravenously and broadly, laying the foundation for the kind of leader he would one day be. By doing so, he proved that knowledge does not belong alone to the school or the professional, but to the hungry and willing, to those who refuse to surrender to the power of knowledge or the paths that lead to greatness. It is indeed the mark of an exceptional man. It doesn't have to be just at a school or the professional that understands this. You can understand. I mean, in the case of Churchill, as I say, my father pointed out last year that he had all these difficulties as a youth, and yet what truly did set him apart in the end, it was the fact that he went out and acquired the knowledge and the understanding on his own, and you just don't see it today. And it's all the more scary, really, when you think about the universities churning out these waves of young people who are ignorant and arrogant. What a dangerous mixture. Finally here, Brad McDonald says, much can be learned about the present and future by studying leaders of the past. And then he goes on and says, that's what Churchill did. He studied the leaders of the past, and those lessons from the past, they shaped his own life, his own ability to lead. They factored into his decision-making when he finally presided over all of the big decisions to make during World War II. Finally, as he said there in his memoir, to paraphrase, I forget the exact wording, but he said, finally, I have the power and the authority to make the big decisions. He had been prepared for this his whole life. And how important was all the reading and the study. Brad McDonald says he wrote a book about the military genius of his great uncle, John Churchill, the Duke of Marlborough. He habitually gleaned guidance from history's most towering figures. The lives of great men held the keys to greatness, which Churchill strove to emulate. See, that's the kind of education we need to strive to emulate. This was what my father really was encouraging our young people, and indeed all of us, to do a year ago at that Philadelphia youth camp. And I would come along a year later and heartily endorse that admonition from that PYC lecture and that admonition as it appeared in the Royal Vision just a few months later. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you tomorrow.